a piece of Canadian history that wanted to speak. So what inspired you to create this project, to kind of visualize this unwritten piece of Canadian history?
I think it's sort of related to what you were saying about the Alexander the Great. I had a very keen interest in looking at queerness through antiquity. And there are a few, there are very few cases, and one of them being, a very famous Hadrian the Emperor, which my husband, Peter Hinton, recently did the opera of Hadrian at the Canadian Opera Company. Like the stories like that, I had gone into other histories of Patroclus and Achilles in the Trojan War. Again, not historical, a myth, but we're blurring those lines constantly with histories and myths. So I was interested in looking at the history of that, which ultimately naturally funneled down to this Canadian history. And it was so serendipitous that about 5 months into developing this work with Toronto History Museums, we had a devised work through the National Ballet. I went to Guelph University and found out that the year I was born, my husband, an artist like Damon de la Vera, who's, we all know from Book of Negroes, Elisa Palmer, who, Fall on Your Knees, all of these artists in their emergence did a show called Taboo, A Sexuality, which was about this same history. And it was so moving to me to know that this story in a way had like chosen me to take it one step further. And when I found this out, my husband was very tight-lipped about it, but he was like, yeah, like you're taking it one step further than we could. And it just points to this thing that I started off by saying, that we stand on the shoulders of people that I think we've forgotten. And I think that's part of pride, is remembering who allowed us to be here today.
Yeah, I mean there are names that are sort of ingrained into the sort of collective Canadian memory, mostly American names like Harvey Milk and so on and so forth. But there are thousands, tens of thousands of lives that were cut short by decisions of government and decisions of the state and people enforcing that. No, it's a dark history. One of the things that you mentioned right at the start around, sort of the queerness in the Navy, and we think about the Second World War and how queer folks would keep up morale for the troops. I don't know if our audience know this, but a really interesting anecdote is the emergence of leather culture in the gay community, really stems out of the motorcycle units of men in the Second World War. So bringing some of those pieces back, and mainly bringing pilfered pieces of German uniform, which were tailored and leather and beautiful and well made, back with them, and creating this subculture that remains in the community even today. It's queerness and how we express ourselves today has so many of these roots. And I wanted to bring it up in the context of, the bonds that are made. We think of history through the lens of, victories and losses, but they are often large movements of men that make these moments in history happen. And when you have large movements of men, there's gonna be a homosexual. You know what I mean? And you, in your email, and we were talking in advance of this, you emailed me and you were talking about the blood of the covenant is thicker than the water of the womb. And that's, I think, where I'm sort of gravitating towards. How much did that particular often misquoted quote align with when you were putting this together?
Yeah, it's so apt that this idea of blood is thicker than water, as we've we've said, it is so misunderstood to mean that the blood of family is more important than anything else. And it's something that had come up, not to talk about past things that have since been reconciled, but when I met my husband, it was a term that was thrown around by my family. And I was going, blood is thicker than water, but what's the water? And this idea of the blood of the covenant is thicker than the water of the womb suggests that, the blood of our brother in battle bonds us more than the waters of birth, which is so innately queer that, so many LGBTQ plus people have to find their families. And so I think in the context of Private Flowers, it was a discovery of how men find or seek solace in other men amidst war. And I don't know how many listeners have been to Fort York, or they probably went there when they're in grade 10, when people do the school, when they do the tours. But to know that there were two men to a bunk in those barracks, like, you're telling me that stuff didn't happen? Come on. Like, it happened. And the sad irony is, I bet it was such an innocent act of what transpired, and yet someone's life, many men's lives were taken because of it.
You know, everyone needs intimacy, you know, and I think that in the eye of being away from home, being drilled and you know, really put to work, and you know, even with the potential of conflict and risking your life, you know, the need for human connection to those around you. You know, there was another digression here, but we reviewed an incredible book called "Gay, Straight, and the Reasons Why," which was a meta study of various biological and medical studies into why people may be gay. And one of the theories of sexuality, you know, people are familiar with the Kinsey scale, which is like 0 to 9, and you know, it's based on your activities and sort of where your experiences land you on the spectrum. But there is another theory of sexuality that that has stuck with me that I think is fantastic, and it's on something like 19 various factors. And I'm not going to go into too much detail, but if you think about your sexual self when you're, you know, alone at night with your husband, how you express yourself sexuality is very different than when you're in a grocery store with your mother. Time and place, you know, has an impact on our sexuality. So when we think of boarding schools, when we think of, military barracks or prisons or large concentrations of large single gender occupancy, you know, the rates of instances of homosexuality go up with it. So yeah, I think people are human, and I suspect that with two to a bunk, and all of the other factors, it is very unsurprising. And I think what brings me to that now, and I think this sort of circles back to your very intentional decision to cast an Indigenous man and a Black man, is that everybody knew homosexual acts were happening all the way through to the end of the Canadian equivalent of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. But it's the enforcement that was sporadic. Like, more than 80 people over those, I think it was a 30-year period, almost certainly did activities. But, you know, maybe it was only 80 of them that were ratted out or caught, or what have you. Do you think that? I'm curious if your intention around casting was tied to how persecution of homosexuality was often weaponized in history.
Oh my gosh, of course. And often with in cases of artistic works, I find that like an impulse and my intuition, they're playing catch up. And so some of these choices will reveal themselves later, and to audience members too. But I wanted to bring all the intersectionalities of my experience I could, and it was wild to me that Rodney Dyverlis and Jarrah Wolfe, who were the two performers, incredible, what an incredible bond ship we have together now. I feel so connected to them that we it was I'm at a loss for words of what I was saying, but just knowing that they'd never collaborated together before, like what a beautiful opportunity to us be in a space together and live and breathe in these histories and also honor history, but in a way, it's part of it's revisionist too. Like we're putting our little stamp on it.
Well, I don't know if it, I mean, it certainly is revisionist. You mentioned earlier, just for our audience's sake, that we don't know the racial makeup of these 80 men that were persecuted. But I think you're also doing a service here by raising the idea that, our history has chosen what they felt was important to record and whose stories were important to capture. Yeah, no, I think I myself, I'm gonna trek down to Fort York and check this out. Starting, I believe, day of recording today, June 23rd. So for everyone hearing this, it's certainly still there. Go and check out Fort York between June 23rd to July 2nd. Potentially longer, I hear, if we get enough foot traffic out there. Now, for our listeners around the country. Who maybe aren't able to get out to Fort York. Is there a way that they can see the performance online, maybe?
That's what we're working on right now, is how that can be distributed wider after its initial art installation. Because the benefit of working in mixed media is it yes, it's an installation, but it's a film too. So there's been some interest from film festivals, and yeah, we're gonna make sure that this can be seen. And the beauty of Fort York's piece is it's free. Toronto History Museums is free to the public, so it's free knowledge, which is wild. So I in that spirit, I'd like to keep it that way, so it's not regulated to who gets to learn this information and who doesn't.
Excellent. Well, I am excited to go and see it, and I saw a glimpse of the film, and it looked incredible of these two performers. Thank you so much, Howie, for joining us, and I really hope that our audience goes and checks it out as we pick through this really sort of hidden piece of Canadian history. We're going to jump to a track, and we will be back just after this.
Never let you go. I've been abused deep down in my heart. I've been abused, and I've been scarred. People talking, trying to break us up. I said they scandalizing my name. Shining thing just to make me feel bad, and anything to make me shame. Let you go. Said I know. Yes, I know. Every day.
Hello and welcome back to Cankway, home of Canada's queer media. My name is Luke Smith.
And I'm Sebastian.
And I'm very excited because we are joined in the studio. People who tune in to CIUT in Toronto will be long-time listeners and fans of our next guest, Ken Stauer. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Good day.
I've adjusted you down a little bit. There we go. Because we're too loud. Now, the reason why we have Ken joining us, we are going to get to a whole whack of other gay news, including Daegu, South Korea. Don't remind me not to forget about that, as well as Italy and Oslo and Moldova and all kinds of stuff later in the show. But before then, something that is very Canadian, very Toronto, happened this past weekend and speaks to the incredible Jackie Shane. We were just listening to Sticks and Stones by Jackie Shane, and maybe this is a good opportunity to invite you, Ken, to let us know why is Jackie Shane a topic of conversation right now in particular?
Well, a long overdue recognition was provided to Jackie Shane this past Friday. The City of Toronto made a proclamation, Jackie Shane Day. And down at the original venue, which was known as the Sapphire Tavern, there was a heritage plaque unveiling to honor Jackie Shane. Jackie Shane was born in Nashville, Tennessee in 1940 and decided and knew at a young age, I say about the age of 13, that she was a woman in a man's body and decided to live life as a woman. This did not necessarily go down that well in racist South USA at the time, and being a black person as well. So as an early-aged adult, moved to, I believe it was Boston, then to Montreal, and found her way to Toronto in 1961, and set up a performance and recording career here in the City of Toronto, along with a gentleman by the name of Frank Motley, also another ex-American, along with all his ex-American accompanying musicians. And Jackie Shane developed her show and frequently played the Sapphire Tavern, located at the corner of Richmond and Victoria Streets here in Toronto. And that's where the plaque was laid, the cornerstone put in this past Friday to honor Jackie Shane. You can imagine in very boring, staid, conservative Toronto in 1961, this black trans performer holding court at the Sapphire Tavern and other venues here in the City of Toronto. But she monologued along on stage about her sexual identity and the like, and had a tough time, of course, but she had the confidence and had made the decision of who she was and the life that she was going to live. And she remained here in Toronto, I think it was up until about 1968, and then shortly thereafter disappeared. And subsequently, it wasn't until roughly 2015-16 that the gentleman that runs the Numero Uno record label in the United States found Jackie Shane, as many were attempting to do, in Nashville. She had gone back to Nashville, Tennessee, and they put together all of the reissued packaging of her material that she recorded, including the live recording from the Sapphire Tavern here in Toronto. A very significant performer and recording artist here in Toronto who played a big role in what was later to be coined the Toronto Sound Show. So, as I said, long overdue for the recognition, and I'm so happy and glad that this was initiative was taken actually by Amanda Burke, who is a filmmaker who has actually completed the documentary that will come out next year on Jackie Shane.
Well, definitely lots to look forward. I know, Sebastian, that you and I have showcased Jackie Shane a couple of times on the show as a key piece of Canadian history. I feel like that's sort of been the unwritten theme of today's show is, you know, we're talking about Private Flowers in the 1830s, leapfrogging to the 1960s, and obviously talking about Toronto Pride from 2 days ago. So it's been a bit of a time warp here on CIUT and other stations that carry the show. So it's been all over the place. But I'm so glad that you were able to get out there. And I believe you met Jackie Shane's niece.
Yeah, that was a very interesting thing. There was a family member of Jackie Shane's that was at the unveiling of the plaque. And when she spoke at the podium, she announced to those in attendance that she lived 3 to 4 blocks away from Jackie Shane for 40 years, never knowing that Jackie Shane was one of hers.
Wow.
And finally, she found out.
Well, we know that Jackie Shane very much sort of disappeared into nothingness, sort of very much hid from the limelight.
Yep.
And I think that thankfully the world is a different place now, that there's more space for musicians and others to take time for themselves.
Absolutely.
Which is excellent. Actually, that reminds me, Orville Peck has a gay country singer out of, Alberta, is based out of Alberta, Canadian gay country singer. Mm-hmm. People will recognize him from his mask. He wears a frilled, not frilled, is it frilled?
Oh, you're speaking of Orville Peck.
He has postponed all of his summer shows. He announced on Instagram that he took a moment and realized, his mental health and physical health is not great, and taking a step back. I think that's so important to do.
Yes.
And kudos for him for taking his own health seriously and making that decision. But, it's unfortunate that, in 1960, 1970, that there wasn't that same space available to do that.
Well, Jackie Shane, without a doubt, left a legacy here in the city of Toronto. And I'm very thankful that a lot of people picked up the load to make sure that she was remembered for all of the wonderful contributions that she made here.
Excellent. Well, there are a number of documentaries coming out soon on that one. Thank you so much, Ken, for joining us to speak to that.
You're welcome.
Excellent. And now moving on, I did want to quickly mention the National Hockey League has decided to pull their Pride jerseys from. Did you hear about this, Sebastian?
Yeah, it's weird and complicated. So they're still going to make what they call political messaging jerseys, but they're not allowed to wear them when they're on the ice. So
yeah, it's the warm-ups for the games. In advance of the games, it's the warm-ups. It's specifically that.
Yeah, hockey is for hockey. They can still make jerseys. You can still sell them. You can still sign them. You can still use the team logo, but they will not be worn on the ice anymore. And when I read this, all I could think is this is the NHL jersey equivalent of either every flag can go up the flagpole or only the Canadian flag can go up the flagpole. And I think they just sort of said, you know what, this is getting weird and complicated and we're just going to simplify it.
Well,
because they are allowed to do almost whatever they want off the ice, so long as it's not too egregious, I think this is a good middle ground where they're basically saying, like, yeah, you can get your Pride jerseys, but we're not going to make anyone wear them on the ice anymore. I think this is an okay compromise.
Well, I'm a little bit more on the fence. I understand for NHL games, the warm-ups before the big games, I can see that. They want the focus to be on the game, not on who did or did not wear a certain, jersey.
Yeah.
But I think that the teams should very much be able to, and I believe they are able to, wear the these colors in games that they do host outside of the NHL. So if they're competing in a friendly or a practice or what have you, an option. But I think this is a knee-jerk reaction from, it's the same decision as Target. It's like, oh, no, there's pushback. Screw it. Let's throw the toys out the pram. And now nobody gets to play
because you can still get Pride-themed jerseys. They are still available, just not for every player.
But it was more about the visibility and being seen. Mm. And this seems to be we've done that. Enough of that now. That's all been done. Now nobody wears a jersey. I don't know. I think on the one hand, I get it. It is a distraction. The story has escalated so far. But it is not a distraction from the gay community. The gay community is like, wow, that's excellent. Thank you very much. But the uproar is coming from very, very strongly opinionated people who are not in the gay community. Like, that is where the pushback's coming from. Now, I did promise, and I have about a minute to get this story in, to talk about
Daegu, South Korea.
Daegu, South Korea. This is excellent. This is an excellent story of that I heard. So the mayor of Daegu is very concerned, among other things, that the festival, the essentially their equivalent of a Pride festival, was going to block the traffic on the road. How very dare they? Whilst at the same time as promoting unnatural sexualities.
Okay.
And the police of Daegu said, well, actually, no, it's fine. And the mayor is like, no, police, let me tell you your job. Sit down. It is actually an obstruction to the roads. Mm-hmm. And the police again were like, no, that's fine. So they took them to court because the municipality under the mayor refused to issue the permits. They took it to the courts. The courts also said, no, this is fine. Freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, they're good. And this mayor and about 200-300 of his staff still adamant that despite the courts and the police all saying it's fine, they were right and they were wrong. So they went and physically blocked access for these trucks to be able to set up for the Pride Parade. And the Daegu police force physically arrested and removed city officials out of the way so that this festival could take place.
Ooh, this the vibes this gives me is like 2009 when Iceland was the only country in the world that sent their bankers to jail.
It is astonishing.
You very rarely see people in power seeing the exact same justice that your average person off the street would see for doing the exact same thing. Like this is, I mean, as much as it is a pride story, I think it's also kind of like an anti-corruption story. Yeah. It's great. Yeah. I love it. It's a great one. It's a great story. Yeah.
Unfortunately, we've run out of sound. Oh, gosh. We've run out of time. We're playing I Got You by Send Help. That was a tongue twister. I've been Nick Smith.
And I've been Sebastian. And thank you for listening.